thank Rob for the introduction and thank the Fulbright Committee. I'm a Fulbright Scholar at the Diplomatic Academy this year. The Fulbright Commission is the one that's actually funded the trip here and recording the lecture. But as Rob said, for a long time I taught for the Naval War College program in Monterey and generally taught a class called Strategy in War. And in the class, we look at a lot of different conflicts, including a lot of the recent American conflicts. And one of the things that I got interested in this through teaching various case studies. And every war you look at since 1945, the United States has been involved in, has been branded a limited war. Whether that term actually fits, is not particularly relevant to whoever's doing the branding. Sometimes it fits, sometimes it doesn't. At the same time, we've been in all these conflicts that we either sometimes have not won them, or the U.S. hasn't won them in the manner that it hoped to, or with the speed that it hoped to. And another question to think about as we go through this, and it's a question I'll offer up to you but not answer, I'll let you come to your own conclusions, is once we get through this, is this the kind of war that, the type of war, the type of struggle that we're more likely, to be involved in? But the place to start is the place that I found when I started doing the research on this, and I'm writing a book on this for Cambridge University Press. And why the talk, and I also give Rob credit for the subtitle of the talk as well, how to think about limited war, because the conclusion I came to is that we really don't understand how to think about it, despite the modern literature dates to shortly after the Second World War. And the basic problems that I discovered that we see with this mess is that the first thing is, and these are the main things I'm going to talk about here today, we don't understand how to define it. And I'll talk about that here in detail a little bit. But because we don't understand how to define it, we don't understand the political objective, we don't understand the effects from that, this has follow-on effects from not being able to link the ways and the means with the objective, being sought, as well. And if you don't understand all of these things, then you can't really successfully calculate how the constraints that are going to be involved in prosecuting these wars are going to affect what goes on. At the same time, the thing that I found most surprising is this here in the literature. There's no insistence upon victory very often, and some of the literature will say you're not supposed to win. Now, and I think those of you who are military officers, they just sent you to the war and they told you, fight the war for 7 years, don't win. I've been teaching this class called Strategy and Policy for the last 18 years, and the unofficial motto of the class is how to win wars. And so that struck me as being just very odd. But I'll get to that in a second as well. And then a failure to end these conflicts, as well, and the problems that this produces. And so I really, this is the guts of my research question in some sense, some of the most important elements of it. And so the problem I've got is I've been reading all this stuff for years. Okay, how do I deal with these issues? And the solution first, you've got to get back to the basic principles of what you're even thinking about when you're talking about strategic subjects. But one of the great weaknesses in strategic studies literature and historical literature and political science literature that relates to this as well is that it's not explained very often or very well on too many occasions by the authors. They don't explain it very well what actually they're talking about. What are they really trying to get? What do they mean when they use these terms? They're thrown about kind of like confetti, very often. And so you have to start from this, with almost all the writing I do on military subjects now, I start with this. The policy, what do you want? What is the objective? What are you trying to get? How are you using your elements of national power to get it? How are you using your military power to get it? What campaigns or operations are you mounting in order to get this? And then the tactical stuff, the battlefield stuff, what are the concerns with that? So you've got to know this before you can really start doing your analysis. Now, when we apply this to the whole idea of limited war, I have two definitions here, on the board. I'm not going to read them to you. Hopefully you can see them and read them, but I'll talk about them a little bit. The first one is from a man named Robert Osgood, who's famous for writing a book on limited war. It's considered the book on limited war. And the bottom definition is from a man named Bernard Brody, both of whom are American. And Brody is also considered one of the other big pillars, in this literature. And when you see You know, I give you their definitions because what they write about, everybody else that writes about limited war essentially digs into this and digs into the stuff that they talk about. Now, but what you see is they don't even know what it is. They don't even agree on what limited war is. And you have these very mixed definitions where with Brody, with Osgood, who's I think one of the better writers, he talks about the objective, which is good. But he talks about the geography as part of what this means. He talks about how the efforts, he talks about settlement, he talks about selected targets, he talks about, you know, oh, you can't commit all of your resources. Brody, he talks about limited war in relation to total war, which is an issue all of its own. You can't, it's not a limited war if you use nuclear weapons and other issues. You know, you have to constrain yourself and mutual constraint. They have two different views of what is going on here, yet they're supposed to be the authorities, you know, on this. So the problem is you really don't have a definition, because the way that it's generally defined is they mix the political objective with the way you're going to get the political objective with the level of means that you're going to use. Brody and a lot of other writers, not just Brody, they define limited war in relation to total war. The problem is the term total war doesn't mean anything. You can't really define it. So I've read entire books that don't define it. So you've got this means-based problem, and they talk about things that affect the nature of the war, the geography, the level of force, you know, and so on. But all of this boils down to means, and means being an element of their definition. This is too subjective. You know, how do you tell when someone has used all of their means? I mean, how much is the means being total? You can't, it just doesn't work for thinking about it very clearly. So you have no basis for your analysis, you know, is what I concluded after reading literature for 4 years. So you've got to fix the problem before you even start. And so go back to basic principles, you know, again, you know, you've got to go to the objective. And so thinking about Clausewitz and thinking about the way that Sir Julian Corbett, the maritime theorist, uses Clausewitz, he kind of imposes a little bit on him. And you can divide all wars into this. Wars fought for regime change, or wars fought for something less than this. And everything that you do, you base it upon the political objective. What is the political objective being sought? Everything else, you know, flows from this. This gives us a really solid basis that then answers all these other problems, you know, in an analytical perspective that I showed earlier. Now, so why do I say this? Well, again, Clausewitz, he talks about the object, the political object, the value of it. The war will go on until people aren't willing to pay the price anymore, until one side says, we don't want to pay the blood and treasure, prestige cost that we're paying for this, we will end. But it really critically, what solves the end ways means problem is this. The political object, the original motive for the war, will thus determine both the military objective to be reached and the amount of effort it requires. There again, why the objective is so important, because you will do things to get the political objective. And so this gives us a solid, you know, basis for then starting to, okay, how do we think about this? How do we analyze it? Now you have all of these other issues that Brody and in some better respects, Osgood come up with, the geography, the means, political will, and the list goes on. All of these things are really critically important for influencing the nature of the war, but they don't define it. You know, that you can't define a war fought for a limited political objective, which I think is a better way to describe it, by these things, because they're too subjective. So if you're fighting a war for a limited political objective, what would these objectives commonly be? Well, if you're fighting defensively, you're trying to hold what you've got, just to keep what you've got, to preserve yourself in the face of an invasion. The most common thing for an offensive war fought for an offensive limited objective is territory. Historically, that's what people fight wars for. But there are also other things, you know, as well. Political concessions, economic reasons. For example, the 19th century in Asia, it's famous for the Americans and for the European colonial powers using military force to force political and economic and trade concessions from China, India, Japan, and other places. You know, what other, you can in theory have as many objectives as you have politicians, which is, that's a lot. You know? So now, so how does this work in the real world then, if you're thinking about how you use this for analysis? And the main case studies I'm looking at are the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the Gulf War. The Korean War, the objective for the United States, you know, preserve South Korea, hold South Korea, supported by UN resolutions in this. The Vietnam War, some of the literature on the Vietnam War insists that the Americans don't have a political objective. That is wrong. I mean, here is spelled out very clearly, NSAM 288, an independent, non-communist South Vietnam. That's a limited political, a war fought for a limited political objective, to hold South Vietnam. The Gulf War, the primary political objective is the liberation of Kuwait. There are other things as well, but in the policy documents, it's spelled out very clearly what this is. We aren't trying to change any of these other regimes. We're trying to preserve regimes in South Vietnam and South Korea, or to liberate, take something away from the Iraqis. Now, problem. Sometimes the political objectives change, and this adds a whole new wrinkle to this whole equation. And it's also a problem why using the term limited war as kind of a blanket is very difficult, and why I prefer to think about wars fought for a limited political objective. Because in Korea, in the limited war literature, this is the archetype. There are books and books and articles about Korea, the limited war. But in September 1950, the political objective changes for the United States. The Truman administration says, we will unify Korea. You're no longer fighting a war for a limited political objective at that point. Here's why understanding the political objective is so important, because you change the political objective, you change the nature of the war. And that's exactly what the Truman administration does. The Truman administration decides to invade a Soviet and Chinese client state, essentially. You know, that changes everything, because everybody else says, okay, what is going on here now? You get the attention that you perhaps did not want. So it changes the war. Sometimes the political objective is fuzzy, and the political leaders get to where they're not really sure what they want. At the end of the first Gulf War, the first President Bush, twice he calls for revolts in Iraq, and that they happen. They probably would have happened anyway, but this certainly arguably feeds it. He says, if Saddam is overthrown, this is the way to end the war. But they really don't want Saddam overthrown, but really they do. They want both, but they're afraid of what happens if he's overthrown, but they're afraid of what happens if he stays. So they get a little fuzzy on what they really want there. The second Iraq War in 2011, the Obama administration doesn't get a status of forces agreement because they don't really want one. There's a lot of controversy around this. Would this have made the situation a little different? I'm getting ahead of myself. That's for later. But in the second Iraq War, initially, U.S. invades Iraq, the objective is very clear. It's regime change. This is a war fought for an unlimited political objective, even though you see it branded a limited war. But then things change. We move from overthrowing a regime to building and then protecting a new regime. This changes the objective. This changes the entire situation, the entire dynamic of what you're doing, which then changes the influence this has on other powers in Iran and Syria, and the effects it has on the internal population as well. So things change. Now, is this a good idea or bad idea to change the objective? It depends. You know, sometimes changing the objective might be a good idea. But the problem that I found with the United States changing the objective is we don't think about it very clearly or think about it as deeply as we should. Or when we do think about it, there's actually a lot of discussion about changing the objective in Korea, but they don't take seriously enough the problems that they can see from the intelligence they might have from this. So it's a very complicated, it's all very easy, as you can tell. So if you're the policymaker, it's easy. So we understand the objective determines so much. Okay, how does this affect all the constraints, the things, the geography, the means, the national will, all these other things that Brody and others have so clearly identified? Well, the first thing to think about is what is the other objective, meaning the objective of the other combatant involved. And this is really critical. And again, why lumping things as a limited war very, very difficult? Because you might be finding a war for a limited political objective. What do they want? And how much value do they place on it? And then how do these things then, how are the constraints generally affected because of this value? How does this contribute to how much means you're willing to produce to it? I'll come back to that in a second in detail, but this is a concept I've kind of taken from one of Robert Osgood's later books when you think about the constraints. And it says, he talks to it, are the constraints actual, meaning you don't have any choice but to deal with them. You cannot alter it. Korea is a peninsula. That's a fact. You can't get around that. That is the situation you have to deal with. Or are the constraints self-imposed, meaning we place them on ourselves? If we do that, is this wise? Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. An example, In the Vietnam War, the Johnson administration would not allow American ground forces to operate north of the 17th parallel in North Vietnam. Their reasoning for doing this is they were very certain they would end up having to fight China in North Vietnam. And so this is a self-imposed constraint, and it's a very wise one, because they're absolutely correct. The Chinese government had made commitments to North Vietnam that they would help them fight the Americans if the Americans invaded, and at times the Chinese government sometimes had as many as 170,000 troops in North Vietnam. So that's a fairly significant other issue to deal with. So it's an imposed constraint, but it's a smart one. Now, how do these other things, when we think about these constraints, work out in Korea and Vietnam? When you think about the objectives again of the various combatants, not just you, when looking from the United States perspective, we also have to consider the other combatants and their allies. What do they want? How does that affect what's going to happen? What are the values of their objects? The geography, how does this work? Well, for constraint, one of the things that the Truman administration does is restrict the war in Korea to Korea. It will not allow American military forces to launch attacks in China because it fears that, because the Chinese are a Soviet ally, that they would get a third world war. And so this is a constraint. The political elements of it filter into this as well. In Southeast Asia, one of the constraints that is placed on American forces for much of the war, not all of it, is that they cannot operate in Laos and Cambodia. This was something the Truman administration very much restricted. Now, okay, then you got to think about what is the effect that this has? It's sanctuary, lines of communication for the enemy, and so on. And certainly a lot of this, the fear of third-party entry affects this as well. Why not go into North Vietnam again? Why not go in to China? That is always there as an element. And then you have the coalition aspects to bring into this again. What are their objectives? What matters to them? What is the value of the object to them? And with the Cold War perspective, it's a whole new wrinkle with this, because you have this something called nested, some people call nested wars, where so much of what the United States is doing is in Korea and Vietnam is constrained or limited by the fears of getting a larger conflict. But what's interesting when you look at this, look at that idea in relation to the first Gulf War, the Bush administration doesn't have that same fear. There's no Cold War. So the external situation has changed. The fear of third-party actor intervention is not there anymore. So this gives you so much more freedom to do so many other things that militarily you couldn't have done in some of these other conflicts. Now, the problem, the means element of this. Almost every definition that you will see and almost everything written about limited war that you will see talks about the means. It says, you have to restrict your means for this. If it's a limited war, if you're using a lot of stuff, define a lot, then it's not a limited war. Again, the problem is too subjective. The reality is you should use sufficient means. When you decide you wish to get this political objective, use sufficient means to get what you want. Because if you have this self-imposed idea that, we can't use sufficient means or enough means, then this really increases the chances of not winning the war. Now, how does this play out? In our Korea, Vietnam, in Gulf War examples. One of the many controversies in Korea is that in 1950, President Truman signs an order dispatching four army divisions to Europe to fulfill our NATO commitment to Europe. This is the height of the Chinese offensive, in North Korea. And so there are writers that say, Kissinger and Brody and others, a better use of these four divisions is in Korea, or sending them later, and in the spring of 1951, you can end this war more quickly with a little bit more force. In Vietnam, the argument then boils down to you don't ever use sufficient means to end the war quickly. In Vietnam, one of the points of argument is always the American military forces, ground force commander Westmoreland, is never given the forces he is asked for from the Johnson administration. He always is giving a piece of it. You have this drib and drab. You can argue about the efficacy of that, but that's the argument. Gulf War, different. Colin Powell, the American military commander, at one point he asked President Bush for a corps, some more carriers, and some more air wings, and he says he needs these. President Bush says, give me the order, I'll sign it. And Bush says later, I didn't want them to be able to say to me they didn't get what they needed. But again, Bush's situation is different as well. And so trying to get this means issue right, you know, can be, it's obviously one of the many, you know, many difficult things, but if you don't use sufficient means, can you end the war? The problem is also how you use these means, which we'll come to in just a second. And another big topic in the limited war literature is limited nuclear war. There is a large amount of literature on this, but at the same time, there's literature saying that if you use nuclear weapons, it's not a limited war. What is forgotten in all of this is that nuclear atomic weapons, these are a means issue. You know, yes, it has enormous political impact if you use these, obviously, but this is an element of means. And in a lot of the early limited war literature, limited nuclear war literature, its discussion is, okay, we can use atomic weapons and later nuclear weapons, and just use a few of these, the Soviets will be okay with that if we're fighting, and this won't produce a nuclear exchange on a global scale. The Soviet writers at this time are looking at this and they're saying, no. Once these are used, all bets are off. No one knows what's going to happen here, because no one can predict it. So you get a lot of interesting and frightening sometimes writing about this. But there's enormous literature written by Indian and Pakistani authors, particularly Indian authors, on limited war, and it touches on a lot of these issues here today. And of course, this is relevant to think about because it's South China Sea, Korean Peninsula. You know, so it's with countries that have nuclear and atomic weapons, when they are involved in any war, sometimes you have, you know, potential issues here that could lead to very bad things, which is something certainly to think about here as we look at this and other related subjects. Now, so you've got these means at your disposal. Hopefully you've got sufficient means, but you've got to be able to use them in a manner that gives you what you want. That's in theory, if you're fighting a war, that's in theory what you're doing. Now, obviously, to talk about strategy in detail, this is a subject for a number of series of other lectures, but just some big things to think about. You know, understanding what you want, having a vision of what the peace should look like, clear political objectives, clear assessment of yourself, your enemy, making sure that you can actually accomplish this goal with military power, because sometimes you can't. You know, understanding your opponent, you know, and just, you know, solid operational planning to back this up, all these things are important. But in a nutshell, what Clausewitz says, what you're doing militarily, it should be affecting the enemy's ability to prosecute the war or their will to prosecute the war. If it's not affecting their ability to prosecute the war and not affecting their will, you really need to question, you know, what it is you're doing. Is this a worthwhile thing that you're undertaking? Now, the problem is, okay, we're looking at our means issue here and the strategy issue, looking at the strategy, but when you look at the limited war literature, you see this insufficient interest in victory. So, yes, we know what we want, sort of, sometimes. We're using means, well, maybe, to get it, but we really don't think we should win the war. And so, I give you these four quotes here. One is from, the top one is from American Navy captain, 1951, veteran of the Pacific War, graduate of the Naval Academy. He's actually a professor at the National Defense University at the time he writes this, which makes it even more interesting. To me. The second one, a man named Garnett, who's one of the fathers of modern strategic studies, a British author, President Barack Obama in 2015, and a Canadian brigadier, you know, from just late last year. So I have dozens and dozens and dozens of bizarre quotes, you know, and interesting quotes, you know, that talk about this. And one of the things that I haven't quite figured out completely in my mind is why you have this. And there are a lot of different reasons. One of the reasons is when the writers in this, when they mention these things, they often confuse victory on the battlefield or victory in a battle with victory in the war or achieving your political objective in the war. Sometimes that's the problem. Sometimes it's like the one in the first one, his concern seems to be that if you have a decisive victory, military victory in Korea, maybe you'll escalate and you'll get a bigger war. You get a war with the Soviet Union. So there's some of that, this fear that you'll get a bigger war, certainly in the Cold War context. The criticism of that is that the people that are writing this way are letting the fear of what potentially might happen in the future cloud their ability to actually deal with the problem that they have on their hands. You know, and they're not addressing the immediate problem because they're afraid of something that may or may not happen. You know, you can argue that both ways. But so you see this in the literature, and again, having taught a class where the motto is how to win wars, it just struck me as being interesting. So what do we get from all this? All of this, you know, again, we don't really understand the literature how to define it. This relates, just gives us a bad end-ways-mean relationship. It confuses our understanding of the constraints. At the same time, you don't have this emphasis, sufficient emphasis on winning. Winning meaning achieving the political objective, establishing a peace. And there's not really a lot of thought given to how to actually end these things, you know, and how to get peace out of it. And the result of it, you could argue, and again, I'm still part of the way here with this, is, you know, you get a protracted war or a perpetual war. Sun Tzu very much frowned on protracted wars. You can make some arguments against Sun Tzu, but some of his points about it bleeding the country are pretty hard to argue against. This quote here is from a lady named Caroline Holmqvist, who's a Swedish political science. And when she talks about this problem, she basically chalks it up to a lack of vision among Western leaders, particularly American leaders. She's right in this respect. Is she right? I don't know, but she's one of the best explanations I've found yet. So, but again, this is something still involved in writing it, and we'll see what I get from this. Now, so we don't really have a way to end, you know, these wars. And one of the things that Osgood wisely points out, he says, look, wars fought for limited political objectives are only solved by negotiations. You don't usually put your boot on the person's neck and dictate the terms from them. You know, you usually negotiate an end to the settlement. The problem is no one plans for this. You know, almost no one plans for this. One of the rare exceptions that I've found is the Russo-Japanese War, where the, 1904-1905, the Japanese know they're going to have to negotiate an end to this war with the Russians when they started. And so they plan ahead for this. They say, okay, we're going to cultivate the Americans. We'll get them to mediate it. We will send one of our diplomats as our representative to Washington, D.C., who just happened to go to Harvard with President Theodore Roosevelt, and they know each other very well. So they're kind of stacking the diplomatic deck before they even go to war. Now, why do people not think about this? Well, I think it's a hard question to answer. Part of it is I think the pressure of the war so often overwhelms the policymakers, which is understandable. You know, without, especially if your country's been invaded, just surviving and prosecuting the war is such a big thing, and any war is such an enormous, it's the most complicated thing human beings do. You know, so that just overwhelms the policymakers very much. But at the same time, often I found quotes from President Johnson and quotes from First President Bush about the first Gulf War. How do we get out of this? How do we get out of this? How do we end this? How do we bring this thing to a conclusion? Where the question is raised, sometimes repeatedly, but no one ever tries to answer it. You know, no one ever sits down and says, okay, how do we actually do this? And the problem that I have with this, I think historically, is if you don't do it right, you might get to do it again. This is why we number our world wars, you know, for example. So I used the three Gulf Wars, you know, as an example, you know, for this. The first Gulf War, 1990-91, the Iraq War, Iraq War I, as I call it, it's just suddenly stopped. They don't really think about, the U.S. doesn't really think about how it's going to end it. And General Schwarzkopf, the CENTCOM commander on the ground, he's given very, very little instruction. Essentially, they tell him, strike a ceasefire, end the war. Schwarzkopf goes, yes, sir. He goes, negotiates it, comes back and says, here's what I got. And they're like, what did you do? And his bosses are mad at him for essentially his first mistake of doing what he was told. But he wasn't given good instruction. Or the second Iraq War, 2011, again, the problem with the status of forces agreement were there. Would this have mattered? There's a lot of controversy with that. It obviously was not done very well. And then you get, starting in 2014, you get the third Iraq War for the United States. Is it going to end with any better war termination? We'll see. Yeah, so maybe after the fourth one, you know, we'll figure it out. Yeah. So you've got this problem that is a massive problem. And to me, and I could totally be wrong about this, I think this is harder than the war in some respects for the policymakers, and I feel just horribly sorry for any policymaker that has to deal with this. In the American military experience, it's often the American military commander on the ground who is the guy that's charged with sorting this out, sometimes with absolutely no preparation, like General Schwartz, and no instruction from his bosses as well. So you've got the added wrinkles with this. So the question that, you know, the difficulty that I've had is trying to figure out how to address this, and I've stolen some ideas from some of the ideas from the course that we've been teaching for years, and three, there's a lot of things obviously to think about here, but three big things to think about. What do you want politically? What are the political objectives? How far are you willing to go militarily, or do you need to go militarily without going too far to get these objectives? How are you going to enforce the peace? You have to think about the step beyond, you know, after the war ends. What is the peace going to look like here? What does victory look like? What does success, you know, look like? But the difficulty that I'm having in writing this, these three things are completely intertwined. You can't think of them as one, two, three. They relate so much together. They're so intertwined. And there's so many factors that overlap with this, it's kind of difficult to decipher it. But all three of them are there. You know, and Clausewitz, again, stresses how much this is the political objective. You know, the peace treaty, which will resolve the conflict. You know, that's what you want. But he also says sometimes the peace treaty is just temporary. The person signs it because they want out, they want a break, or whatever. How do you secure the peace? Well, you got to get them to make the peace, too. How do you bring the people to make the peace? And Clausewitz gives us kind of a laundry list. And very much, he said, this is a war. Here's how you do it. You can destroy their forces. Now, this goes against the grain of a lot of the limited war, actually almost all, the limited war literature. They say, no, you can't destroy the enemy's forces. No, nowhere in the Great Book of War does it say that because you're fighting a war for a limited political objective that you can't bring the enemy around to your point of view in that way. You can take their territory, which is a common way, temporary occupation, a temporary invasion, something of a political purpose, and if you're fighting a defensive war, well, you just simply have to absorb what you've got and hope you can fight long enough to take it. For Clausewitz, what's the right answer? What is the situation that you have? You've got to understand the situation you have in order to understand, you know, what the right answer is. Some other things to keep in mind when you're trying to end the war. Again, what does peace look like? What does victory look like here, you know, in this? Having that is something we really should figure out before we've started. Again, sometimes you don't get that option. You don't get that choice. But ideally, you should, but ideal versus real. The timing of it, this can be critical. One of the criticisms leveled at the Truman administration is that in 1950, they have won the Korean War. When American Army and Korean armies reached the 38th, South Korean armies reached the 38th parallel, they've won it. Now is the time to try to consolidate that and make a deal if you can, you know, but the criticism is they missed the chance. One thing, too, to think about, one of the weaknesses I found looking at some of the American side of this is not understanding that the negotiations are a weapon, where negotiations are a tool for getting what you want. If you haven't been able to get it on the battlefield, maybe you can get it at the peace table. The other side sometimes understands that much better. The Chinese negotiators understood that much better, you know, in Korea than we did. The coalition issues with this matters. You know, and we forget this. It matters when you go to war. It also matters when you want to end the war, because every combatant has their own objectives. The negotiating the ends to the Korean and the Vietnam Wars, the United States, we essentially bludgeoned our South Korean and South Vietnamese allies into accepting the peace that we wanted them to accept, bludgeoned with threats, money, aid, whatever it took. But that's just the reality of how business is done. And it's better to get a peace instead of a ceasefire, but sometimes that's all you're going to get. You know, and sometimes you have to take what you can get, you know, from it as well. So, okay, again, why even look at this? I mean, a limited wars fought for limited political objectives. You could look at what's going on, happened in the Ukraine in the last few years. Putin, if I don't pretend to understand his objectives, but just from, you know, based on what I've read and seen, he appeared to have limited political objectives in the Ukraine. He used subversion, military force, cyber, all kinds of different elements of national power to get what he wanted. Hasn't been able to, you know, negotiate an end to that. Maybe doesn't want to. Again, it depends on who you ask. There's an enormous body of limited war literature written by Indian authors. And some people look at this, they look at the South China Sea and think about that. You think about Korea, and you think about, well, is this more likely, you know, the kind of war to get? You know, again, I leave that question to you. And I conclude with this. The first, the supreme, the most far-reaching act of judgment that the statesman and commander, the political leader and the military leaders, and it's important to bring that out, have to make is to establish the kind of war on which they are embarking, either mistaking a foreign or trying to turn into something that's alien to its nature. This is the first of all strategic questions. And so when I started looking at this limited war thing, that we don't know how to think about what we're doing. We don't even know how to define it. We can't even agree on what we're doing. And then we can't agree on the various things that we're doing in this thing that we can't agree upon. So if you can't even define it, you can't understand it or explain it clearly, how are you going to get to the end of it? How are you going to solve the problem until you figure it out? So thank you very much, and I'll take any questions that you might have.